Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LeDuc. Shaker Museum's first pop-up exhibition of 2024 is entitled Palm to Poplar, Devotional Labor. It's an exhibition of original paintings by Caitlin McBride, and it's currently on view in a gallery at Kinderhook Knitting Mill in Kinderhook, New York, through April 28th. Palm to Poplar showcases McBride's paintings of Shaker objects, alongside pieces from Shaker Museum's archive that have inspired her. Caitlin McBride is an artist based in Hudson, New York. Her work has been written about in the New York Times, Modern Painters, Art Forum, New York Magazine, and on Vogue.com. She's currently the co-chair of painting for the MFA program at Bard College. I met McBride and Shaker Museum Director of Collections and Research, Jerry Grant, in the gallery in Kinderhook.
This is our third year of doing pop-up exhibits. We were forced to close our main exhibition gallery in Old Chatham about 10 years ago. The building had just run its course, ADA compliance and fire safety and such. We just decided it wasn't really a good environment either for our collection or for people. So we started doing pop-up exhibits, and for those, we just mined the world of creative people in the area. Caitlin came to us through, and she'll have to correct this, but through a friendship with one of our staff members who suggested that she was doing things related to the Shakers, and that caught our interest, and then we were in touch with her, and it just developed from there.
Caitlin, why the Shakers? How do you experience them? Why is your art representing their items?
I guess I got into the Shakers years ago because I was doing paintings based on objects in the Met's collection, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and I was kind of trying to find something that felt closer to my own personal history. I saw this amazing exhibit they did that was pairing Shaker objects like furniture with modernist artists like Martha Graham Stantz and Osamu Noguchi sculptures, and I was just like amazed. And so I started doing some research on it and found their manifesto for making things. And the more I researched them, the more it felt like there was actually kind of a personal connection to the way I'd grown up, which was in a New England working class family that was pretty religious, but also like kind of hippie-ish and really progressive in other ways. And there was something with the Shakers. It felt like home. It felt familiar in some ways. And even though they were such delightful weirdos, like so was my family. So it felt like there was something really familiar there.
Jerry, how do the pop-up exhibitions like this one, how do they serve the overall purpose of the museum's mission?
You know, the museum is in a major capital campaign to build a new museum in Chatham. And I think that one of the first jobs we had when we started this endeavor was to really broaden our audience and just bring more people under our tent. We've done a couple of things. We've done the pop-up exhibits. We also have a maker circle. So we've put together a group of, I think it's about 20 people who are artists, designers, just that we consult with and try to get their ideas about ways that we can use Shaker things in the broader context to ever grow our audience.
Caitlin, let's look at something. Where would you like to begin?
I'll talk about this one first. So this is a painting that I did, I guess, like a year or two now. And the main object in it is a collating shelf that was used in the print shop. The Shakers had a magazine that they put out. It was called their Manifesto, and the different pages that would be stacked on here before they put them together. And it just seemed like such a beautiful form to me. Like the way that it is made is like totally Shaker, where it's like everything has to be utilitarian and like pared down in this way where there couldn't be any like decorative elements. But then they believed once you did that, then you could make it as beautiful as possible, because that was a way of giving praise to a higher power. And I went to go on a tour at one point to like see some really specific objects that I'd just seen in the online archive. And Jerry showed me around and I got to see it. So as I was working on this painting, I knew that I wanted, we can walk over toward it. I knew that I wanted to put objects on the shelf. Like I wanted it to have the functional aspect of a shelf, but I wasn't totally sure what objects they were going to be. I was like, I know I want something that feels like it's living. Like I want a plant to be on one of the shelves. And as I was working on this painting, and they take a bunch of layers, but I listen to like podcasts and NPR all the time while I'm painting. And it was the week that Roe was overturned, and I was kind of like trying to, I'd gone back and forth over a couple plants, but this plant that's on it is pennyroyal, which was a natural abortificant that was used back in like colonial times and through history. I had just found that it actually grows down by the railroad tracks in Hudson where I live. And it kind of struck me as meaningful in a way, like it isn't really something that the Shakers would have used. They lived a celibate lifestyle, but it was something that just felt like a part of history that needed to be acknowledged. And so I paired it with some other Shaker objects, which are this teacup, which I'll have Jerry talk a little bit about, and a pruning knife. And this is a tea ball that's hanging from a string with another piece of pennyroyal that goes over it. The teacup is rumored to have been drank from by Mother Ann Lee, the founder, but I'll let Jerry talk about that a little more.
Yeah, tell me about the teacup, please.
Well, the history of the teacup, it was given to the museum by the Shakers at Canterbury, New Hampshire, back in the 1950s. And at that time, their history was that it was a cup that Mother Ann Lee had brought 250 years ago this year from England to America when the Shakers came here first, and that it was her teacup. We know from further study that, in fact, it was made around 1810, so it was not the cup she brought, but it's, I hate to use the word relic, but I call these remembrances, things that the Shakers kept that were associated with some of the early founders. It certainly had a lot of importance, and it's what they believed it was and how they kept it that was more important than the fact about whether or not it was really the right cup or not.
Can you also tell me about the knife?
Well, the knife is a pruning knife, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, a tool used for pruning and grafting plants. The Shakers did a lot of orchard work. They were great orchard people, developing their own apples and whatever else. So this was just a knife used for doing that work.
It's an intimidating kind of weapon.
It's so funny, like also having it on display next to the teacup, because it's so heavy and foreboding looking, and then the teacup is so delicate and beautiful and fancy. And yeah, I kind of, that's like something I always try to find in my paintings, is this balance between the delicacy and a kind of like more aggressive, potentially violent like energy that comes into it.
The piece that Caitlin picked, the collating shelves, came from a collector in Troy, or Brunswick, Helen and Charles Upton. And when I first saw it in their house, it was in their bathroom with towels in it. So
it's a good usage.
Good use, yeah. So
it felt kind of relevant having it in here, because like as I was writing the artist statement for the press release, I was just thinking about like how part of my interest in becoming an artist was in like actually the knowledge that comes from doing things with your hands, which I think is really close to a Shaker understanding of the world. And for me, like my first memory of making something that I would consider art was making a book, and like my mom showing me how to bind a book. And so I think there was something just really like special about finding that collating shelf and thinking about like the making of a book, which was something that we got to do through the Shaker Museum too, was we did a workshop at the Hudson Area Library with kids making zines and books and magazines and stuff like that.
That's great. This is another, the first one we discussed was rather large, and this one is also large, but there's all different sizes of paintings in the exhibition.
Yeah, this is actually the one that kind of, I had been on a tour of the collection before, but it was the painting that I was working on that got me to reach back out to Jerry and be like, can I go on another tour? I have specific things I want to see this time. I am really interested in textiles as an art form, even though I'm a painter. And I oftentimes think about like the way that the layers of the painting are weaving, like warp and weft, like what's going over, what's going under, the way it's kind of sitting together. And so I'd wanted to paint a loom for a long time. I think I've painted one loom that's a Shaker loom before this, but this one I was working on, and I always work from the photos that are online, like the online archive photos that museums have. And this one I was trying to figure out what was in front and what was in back, because it was hard to tell from the photo. And so I reached out to Jerry and he took me to go see it. And that's how I learned about what was actually woven on this loom, which is where the title of the show comes from. The title of the show is Palm to Poplar. And originally palm leaves were woven on this. They were like split into really thin strips. And then during the Civil War, it was hard to get palm fronds from the South. And so the Shakers started using poplar bark and kind of like splitting it into these really thin pieces, which Jerry is better at explaining than I am. So maybe I'll let him talk about that a little bit.
Okay, great. Poplar.
Poplar, go. Yeah, when the Shakers couldn't get access to palm, and they were using it for not only for bonnets, but for covering little boxes to sell in their gift shops and a lot of that fancy good trade. One of the Shaker brothers figured out how to cut poplar, which is a pretty useless tree. I mean, not totally, but pretty useless tree, into billets. And then those could be shaved into shavings. And then the shavings were straightened and then shred into very narrow pieces that looked a lot like palm. And they'd worked out the technology of weaving those with a cotton warp instead of weaving palm on palm, which is what they did in the early days, which is really time-consuming and difficult. And so once they had that technology, they could weave this poplar, this cloth made out of poplar wood. And then they used that for covering little boxes to sell in the gift shops.
I need to find a video about what you're saying, because I can't picture it.
Actually, we have a really wonderful document in the library that one of the Shaker sisters at Canterbury photographed all the different steps in making poplar ware. Okay. And so we have it from basically from the harvesting of the tree to the finished product, step by step, all those pieces. And we actually have the tools, the planer, the shredder, and the looms.
So we're going to bring it back.
Yeah. Yeah, that's like one of the cool things of the museum is like it really like boggles my mind of how you do these things. And I think like they're not really in like normal practice anymore. And so it's really cool to go and see, like they have all the little samples of the woven things, which I think we usually think of these things as like I had always referred to them as straw bonnets, which is what is in that painting, is like this woven, it looks kind of like straw, but it was actually palm leaves. And I think like this piece was interesting to me in that transition between the materials, because it's something I think about a lot when I think about American history, is like which materials were used at what time and like what that said about what was happening. And the last show that I did in the city was at Deanna Evans Gallery in Tribeca, and it was called Dyeing Notes, and it was about the New England textile mills and how they had originally been using cotton and then had to switch back to using wool during the Civil War. And then they tried to figure out how they could actually like weave cotton and wool together so they could still get like good dye to stick to it, because the dye would stick to one, but it was easier to weave with the other. And it's one of these things where it's like you can look at the object and not see that history, but it's like tragic, violent history going on at the same time. And I think that's one of the things that I think, like, living in the Northeast for most of my life, like, you're able to, like, not see certain histories. But when you look at the objects and what kind of materials they were made out of, you can see the history really easily there.
What are the characters around the edge here, or the two of the four edges?
Yeah, so that is Shaker spirit writing, I think. Is that the right term, Jerry?
I think that's a fair term.
It's from one of the Shaker gift drawings, which were drawings that oftentimes the Shaker sisters made that were a spirit that had passed or existed in the beyond realm would tell them a message, and they would do a drawing or writing based on that, and then someone else would translate it. And there's a couple different examples of that in here. But it's not really, from what I understand, it's not really writing that can be translated one-to-one. Mm-hmm. It's more like existing in a spirit realm. Am I explaining this right?
I think you're fine. I mean, the explanation we used, which is, I think it's actually called psychographic, is the right term.
That's a name for your next show.
Yeah, there you go. And I explain it as being a lot like speaking in tongues, like what it would be if you were writing down somebody speaking in tongues. It requires somebody to do it and then somebody to actually interpret it. Yeah. We've lost the interpreter.
It's interesting. There's a couple different examples of it in here, like that little piece in this painting is spirit writing of Mother Ann Lee's signature, and it's really tiny. It's in this box over here.
Oh, yeah.
There's something really like haunting about the presence of the actual objects, which like some of the objects just feel like so like normal and utilitarian. Like this tool that I painted here that's hanging on the wall
is a very pretty wrench.
Yeah. It's a very pretty wrench. Yeah, I think it's probably a manufacturer. There's no manufacturer's name on it, but my guess is it was made by somebody in the Shakers. Bought good tools, you know, things that they couldn't buy, they made. But this is a good example. We collect things that they used and things that they made. So
it's the most appealing wrench I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's a beautiful wrench. And it was like very, I like to think of the objects as my muses, like for the paintings. And it was a very good muse. It gave good painting. And yeah, I think it's just interesting looking at the Shaker Museum's collection, because some things are like that where you're like, it's beautiful, but it's totally functional. And then it kind of helps me understand things like the spirit writing or the gift drawings that like it's also functional or was functional for them, of like transcribing a message maybe from someone who had passed on or maybe from one of their leaders who had died. And so there's a functionality in that, but it's also like just incredibly beautiful, strange, like they're gorgeous drawings, like on their own as art. And then in this painting also with the Mother Ann Lee's writing, there's a bonnet that is, they're called caps, and it's a mesh cap. And I think I've heard a couple different things while I was putting the show together, but Jerry, were they worn more by young girls, or was it like a certain time of day you would wear one of these?
I think they were worn indoors and sometimes underneath a regular bigger bonnet. There's a thing about women coming to the age where they put on the cap. Mm-hmm. And I think about that more in terms of Catholic nuns, I think. And I don't know that tradition well enough to talk about it, but I think around age 15, young sisters were presented with a cap that they were then to wear. They had reached an age where that was their proper attire. Before that, they, you know, didn't. The whole thing with Shakers and hair is interesting. It's, you know, the Shakers are always fighting pride and vanity. It's always about community and not about the individual. So I think hair is one of those things where long, short, curly, blonde, brown, you know, we always have that too.
Oh, a really good head of hair will break up a whole community for sure.
Right, exactly. So, you know, for the most part, Shaker women covered their hair. Shaker men had one style of haircut for men, sort of bangs across the front and long and back. So it was a great equalizer, I think. So the cap and the bonnet all had to do with that.
I love the Shaker man haircut. It's like a beautiful mullet. It's like, it's wonderful. And with I think it is interesting how like so many faith traditions, if you look at them historically, have some sort of like hair covering garment. And this one was really there was an essay that another like Shaker aficionado gave me while I was working on this show, Sarah Margolis, where it was called The Cap. And it was about like a girl who had joined the Shakers, and her dad kept trying to like take her back to like the outside world. And he would come and take her and like take her cap off and stomp it on the ground. And it was like this, like, you will not be a Shaker woman. And then she would like run back and try to join again. And it just was kind of interesting to think about like that age of like girls that are like hitting puberty, and kind of like in a way that it felt like a choice for living the life that you wanted to live for many of them, like joining the Shakers, that in an era where there was like not a whole lot of choice over marriage or who you would marry, or like having any kind of, I don't know, like
way to not be seen as someone who should be bred with.
Yeah, totally. And like to be the Shaker women, like lived equally with the Shaker men. And I could understand the appeal of that. Like, and I think having done a bunch of research into my own family history, it helped me understand it more. Like just seeing like a lot of the really awful relationships that women were in the 1800s, of like, in my family, there was a few of them who got divorces and then became a servant of their husband because there was no way they could support themselves. And so it was just, it really led me to understand like the huge appeal, even if you did have to choose a celibate lifestyle, that that was like a very appealing thing versus like being in an abusive relationship or not being able to feed your children or something like that. And I think also from looking through the archives and reading about it and just looking at history in general, it felt like an amazing opportunity for queer people at the time that you like didn't have to choose marriage, that there was some other way of living. And since they did everything in a same-sex oriented fashion of whether it was their daily job or like sleeping all in the same room at night, that kind of thing, that it felt like it was like another option other than like a heteronormative nuclear family.
Congratulations on the work and the exhibition. And thank you so much for taking me around it and talking about your process.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you so much for coming.
Shaker Museum presents the pop-up exhibition Palm to Poplar, Devotional Labor at Kinderhook Knitting Mill in Kinderhook, New York through April 28th. Our guests have been artist Caitlin McBride and Shaker Museum Director of Collections and Research, Jerry Grant. To learn more, visit shakermuseum.us, and that link will be posted along with this conversation at wamc.org. I'm Sarah LaDuke, and you're listening to The Roundtable.